Oh, hey there. I am Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winnie Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hi there, Beardy.
Hello. I've let my chops grow together in my illness.
Yes.
Also, I'm sorry, I have illness voice. An academic / Pop Rocket fifth Beatle, Karen Thompson.
Hello, it's always a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you, Karen. Now, Karen, you're old hat at this, but every week we start off the show by taking a question from a listener about our own pop culture tastes. This week, I want you guys to tell me what's your favorite song using a non-traditional instruments for their genre. I will kick us off by saying I'm a big fan of the 1812 Overture. I love it for its excess. I love it for, like, it's hard because I always insist that I don't care about an artist's, like, biography, but Tchaikovsky's homosexuality, I feel, does lead to a little bit of the wretched excess of this magnificent song that is essentially, ha-ha, French people, you tried to invade Russia during the winter time.
Is it our first gay anthem?
It really is the first gay anthem.
Wow.
And, like, throwing actual fucking cannons onto the stage is just, like, that's the...
It's like Margaret, glitter on top of a sundae on top of
it's the first
unicorn.
Meat dress. Like, way to really get it, Margaret. Nice work. Winner, what's your favorite non-traditional instrument?
On Watch the Throne, which is Jay-Z and Kanye's co-album, which is peak Yeezy and peak Jay, Gotta Have It, I think it's the fifth track, they use a kazoo. And I listened to this album from top to bottom when it came out. And I'll never forget the moment I realized that there's a fucking kazoo in this rap, this epic rap battle with homies. And I love the fact that somebody said, you know what, I'm going to put a kazoo in this shit.
There's no instrument that's more gangsta.
Right?
Keep it in your back pocket.
Right.
Margaret, what about you?
I instantly thought of Beach Boys' Good Vibrations for the electrotheremin, but I have to give a shout out to what I'd like to call the sitar wars of the 60s, when the Beatles had Norwegian Wood, and then the Rolling Stones were like, wait a second, we're going to come up with Paint It Black.
Take that. It is... Like, that was such a magnificent moment of us getting excited enough as a nation that Ravi Shankar became a celebrity in this country.
I know.
And we got Norah Jones out of it.
Yeah, right? True.
Yes.
I don't know if that's a great...
I'll take it.
Karen?
Actually, you know, I thought I was going to come up with one of the earlier examples of a really non-traditional instrument in a particular genre. But, you know, I love this song because... And this non-traditional use of an instrument in it, it's the Carpenters' Goodbye to Love. Uh-huh. It's a middle-of-the-road ballad. And then when you start kicking up at the end, you have the Tony Paluzzo fuzz rock guitar solo. You know, and it just sort of, that was such a shocking, surprising thing to come at that
moment.
I don't
understand what you're talking about. What is that?
It's
a time when I wish, like, for some of these music ones, we probably should be able to listen to them, but what is the...
Well, it's a hard rock guitar solo.
Oh, okay.
In the middle of a love ballad, you know, the Carpenters'
Goodbye to
Love.
Yeah, that was like the 80s.
It was like, the go-to and the very first instance of that in a kind of... middle of the road love ballad was in the Carpenters' Goodbye to Love, and that just really transformed what we know of. It created this oxymoronic genre we think of as soft rock.
Yeah.
So, you know, I love that. It just kicked everything off.
Oh, that's so charming.
Yep.
Thanks to Ocelot Matrix and the Maximum Fun Reddit for that question. Coming up on this week's show, we will be talking about Tuesday night's Grammys. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Margaret Wappler, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. I watched a couple episodes, and of course she gets out her knives on the Republican debate, which, let's just say, was an absolute disaster fest, and any comedian should be able to attack that. But she really gets out some great zingers, and I had this thought that, like, oh, is this field, this Jon Stewart field, kind of like crowded at this point? Like, there's too many people that are now on that are just taking the news of the day and riffing on it. But
there have been a couple of interesting articles about the fact that Trevor Noah's version is now essentially the most lifeless version of that going on.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like he's gaining the traction that he should. And yeah. I feel like in part because Samantha Bee and these other people are kind of pulling away from his audience, what right. should have been his Jon Stewart carryover audience.
Yeah.
And she, you know, the show starts with a Peaches song.
Yeah.
The boys want to be her. And that sets the tone right there, that right. there's going to be these kind of like not safe for work kind of moments yeah. in the show, very much so. Like, there's a lot of really borderline raunchy jokes in it. I was impressed.
Yeah. Well, there is also something interesting about the fact that TBS, which has for such a long time been a space for us to watch our favorite CBS sitcoms of 10 years ago, mm-hmm. TBS and True TV, working together through corporate synergy, have been working to make themselves relevant and interesting places for comedy again.
Yeah. And I mean, again, like, you just think, what is she going to bring to it that no one else can? But you really feel the womanness of the space that she creates, you know, this real like feminine insight into the world and feminist insight into the world that no one else really has right now.
I still haven't seen it. Several people have posted stuff really, really excited. What are the other things that you think just makes this distinctive and exciting to you?
There's just a different voice to it. There's a different perspective. Like, you can tell that, you know, she's gotten a lot of credit for stocking her writer's room with people that aren't just white men.
Yeah.
And you can feel that in the show. There's jokes yeah. that she makes that just could not come out of a male brain unless they knew some things.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's that. It's just that angle that she taps into so perfectly. And she also has a lot of energy on the stage and kind of walks around and moves on the stage, which is different from whatever yeah. everyone else does with like sitting at the desk thing.
Right.
So that alone, too, just kind of cues you in that there's going to be a different energy to the show.
It's hard because I love a nice desk, but I feel like a lot
but
of guys
done.
Are trapped
it's
behind
so
it.
It's so done.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was always the best thing about The Daily Show. I mean, really yeah. one of the most like standout.
Yeah, and she
space takers.
Yeah.
Yes, she brings that same kind of incisive wit to the interviews that she does. Mm. Like, yeah, you guys, you got to watch.
I mean, I was just so charmed that she corresponded in her way through a pregnancy. Like, she,
yeah.
like, when women, like, represent to the world the shit that can be done with a human being lodged inside of you, it's always like, good, we need to be reminded of this. Winnie Mitchell, what are you all about this week?
You know, Kanye, it's what a year. We've been over a year now on doing Pop Rocket.
Yeah.
And I think
a little bit over a year.
A little bit over a year. And a year ago, I think I was singing his praises for this Paul McCartney song he did, Only One.
Right.
And now I'm sitting here. The album's out. Not that impressed.
Uh-huh.
And as a true fan, I'm allowed to fucking say that. And then the tweets. And the tweets are so bizarre. And the tweets are so all over the place that I really, like, I struggle. As somebody who champions creative
geniuses. So for people
geniuses,
who haven't, who didn't see them, the biggest one was that he said he was $53 million in debt.
Well, he said he was $53 million in debt, which I believe.
But then, I believe that too. But then there was also the tweets before that with
about
the Amber Rose
with the
feud.
Amber Rose, which I was willing to let go as like as just promo. But now it's got, we're going into places that are deep and dark. We're talking about the
Bill Cosby is innocent.
I was let me just a note on Amber Rose. I was annoyed with the butt shaming. I was annoyed that anyone is behaving.
They both were butt shaming. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they were both butt shaming. But the thing about it is that there's another thing that he should understand is both of them should understand is nobody wants to know about that. I don't. But I also feel like this period of revealing yourself and not making it into a cohesive thought. It might have worked in 2015. We might have had the patience for it in 2014. But in 2016, as brutal as this year has been, this year has been basically like, sorry, this is just going to happen and you're just going to deal with it. I need this to end.
I can't listen to someone say, I'm $53 million in debt.
No.
Give me money.
Stop giving money to children in Africa.
Because I'm the greatest genius of all time.
I can't.
And I'm selling $510 sweatpants.
And, like,
I'll only put the album on Tidal.
Right.
Yeah. Like, what are you doing? If you're in debt, put it everywhere so we can all get it.
He claims it's not, right? Isn't that another contradictory claim? It's just like, no, it's going to be available beyond Tidal.
No, but then he says it's never, ever, ever, ever going to be an Apple. Yeah. And to me, and it's like, look, I am no psychiatrist, I am no therapist, but I know a little bit about mental illness. And if this man is having a nervous breakdown or having a psychiatric break, if you love him, and you are near him, you need to take him to someplace quiet
and
give him
Kim
a break.
Kardashian, what are you doing?
Like, do something.
That's
because that's...
Kim's not going to do something reasonable.
She's going to take a selfie with him.
I did wonder if this was a first stab at divorce paperwork.
Oh, yeah.
I wondered if it was an interesting way of creating a narrative of, I don't have that much money. Though I'm sure that they have a prenup that,
he
did write Gold Digger.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, he has fears about these things. Yeah. But yes. I saw this headline, I think it was in Jezebel, that was like, Kim Kardashian wishes that Kanye wouldn't tweet so much. And it was like,
which, by the way, is, by the way, I'm very well versed in the ways of celebrity gossip and how stories are concocted. And I've talked amongst the committee of journalists. Current and former, and in the world of tabloid, we had a confab, if you will, in the last 2 days, and this is 100% initial. I'm marriage separation conversation.
Ooh.
100%.
You heard it.
I am fascinated by the difference between, like,
by the end of 2016,
she is so much about a. Shaped oversharing, like that family works through shaped oversharing, and this is such unshaped oversharing.
Yes,
well, and she's also sweet.
Yeah,
she's not particularly mean about her oversharing.
Right,
she's pretty like benevolent, and he's kind of been striking.
She's
these
created
notes.
The standard for the forms of oversharing that we as amateurs participate
right.
in.
Right, well,
and that we accept her norms. We accept her norms, and his are like. Like working the VMAs and having that guy get up, and there was something so magnificent about like, nobody's going to turn off this mic. Nobody's going to go to commercial. He's more powerful than this space, and have him.
You're talking about with the Taylor interruption.
It was him presenting the thing or no
the
Taylor
Vanguard Award.
Yeah. The Vanguard Award to him when he declared his candidacy for president in 2020. Yeah. And it was like a magnificent shit show. But there was something nice about it. And to me, it's a little bit sad. Like, I never liked anything beyond his poppiest of works. And he was slightly annoying to me. But there was something great about this guy. Just keeps hitting him out of the park. And everybody says everything he does is genius. And isn't it? That's kind of fun. And this narrative of him being down is kind of...
The disturbing part of his unraveling is so much about, like, airing the thing that we don't like to see aired, and that's, like, your financial dirty laundry.
Right.
Asking other people for money, and then saying, I would love to be the head of the House of Hermes.
Right.
Know,
but the thing is that nothing will take away from the fact that Kanye is a genius. I really do believe that in his world, creatively, what he's created is very, very, very important. Just as a contributor to music and art and just the landscape, what I think we're dealing with and what we're facing is that in 1956, if Pablo Picasso had a meltdown, Pablo Picasso had a meltdown, and you didn't hear about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was having a meltdown somewhere in Spain, and it was a lot of thrashing and Spanish being flown around.
Eventually, Ariana Huffington would write a book about it,
right.
And then Merchant Ivory would make a movie that nobody saw about it.
Exactly. Yeah, but he's giving us full meltdown, and we are subject to it when stuff – usually we push somebody into a 51-50 hold.
The public meltdown as – tool for reconstructing your career is an interesting thing.
Yes.
These people that we are now discussing are my friends, but Brody Stevens, a well-known comedian, had 72 hours when he was tweeting and clearly melting down and just realizing like...
Recently?
No, this was years ago.
Okay.
But it was like, oh, my friend hasn't slept in 72 hours. Mm-hmm. What's going on? And I and many others sent him like, is everything okay? But the thing is that like he had just been dropped by CAA. A project he was working on with Zach Galifianakis didn't happen. And then after the meltdown and the media cycle around the meltdown, his show went. And CAA took him back. And it was an interesting, like, it worked out, you know?
The self-conflagration to rise like a phoenix.
Yeah.
Is this a Britney Spears or Lindsay Lohan level meltdown of, like, all hands on deck? I don't think it is.
No. I would say it can't happen to a boy that way.
No.
The thing is that, like, there's... I've always insisted that there's nothing that a man celebrity can't pick himself up from and say again, I'm a genius, where we consider women soiled beyond return to some extent.
I think that's so happened to Lindsay Lohan.
But Lindsay, much like Kanye, much like Britney, could not be told anything. with Britney, she has a family. So there's a family structure in place. No matter how dysfunctional and white trash you want to call it, there's a brand and a family structure in place. She had a swath of a demographic of fans that she had to attend to. What is the decision? Medicate her. Make her go out like a robot. Lindsay, she wasn't working with the same amount of money and brand in there. It was her way or the highway. Complete, you know, this is irrelevance now.
One thing I think is just interesting in that difference is the place of music in their career. And there is this weird way that we can accept a certain, like if you are a female music star with a gay fan base, they will always be there.
Right.
And it doesn't necessarily and it doesn't work that way for an actress. Like there is something about the Judy of it all that makes it be like,
girls at Judy.
I mean, like boys I know going to Las Vegas to watch Britney's show and just being like, she's standing up. Like they're just so happy for her. And there was like, I don't know if you guys were aware of it on your social media feeds, but there was like a news cycle about Britney's kind of together. Like Britney's not so terrible on stage anymore.
She wants a nerd with a big dick. And I'm like, yes, girl, so do I.
No, this wasn't that. This was like 8 months ago. And the story was she's less shitty in her show in Las Vegas. Now she's, you know, she's getting the words. And it was
did you see that she started the show back up and somebody did a cut of her last show with the same routine and the new show just opened last night.
No.
It's like night and fucking day. We're getting Britney 2004. Like, she's basically time traveled back to right before she broke her knee and she's coming back to us. And I think, and I'm like, yes, girl, thank you.
That's lovely.
That's brilliant.
Karen Thompson, what are you all about this week?
In an oblique fashion, it's related to the Kardashians, or not even so obliquely,
but it's
the People versus OJ.
Don't kill yourself in Kimmy's room.
Exactly. It's like, it's Daddy on TV. And what I'm talking about, of course, is the People versus OJ Simpson. And I'm not a fan of the true crime genre in general or the American crime story setups for the most part. I don't watch those regularly, but there's something about the opportunity to see what was already campy in its historical moment be reenacted in its like deep and profoundest historical camp to the point that David Schwimmer
We figured out what to do with Ryan Murphy. when the facts are in place, when there are things that he cannot deviate from, he can fill up the spaces in between so beautifully.
Yeah.
Like John Travolta as Robert Shapiro is so magnificent, and it's all of the too much he's been giving us in all of his roles, but it makes perfect sense. And thank God he realized his career was at a place he should do a TV show.
It takes a lot of humility for that.
He can barely move his face. It's fascinating,
and that's part of what makes him a perfect Robert Shapiro.
Don't you feel like the whole thing is quite Lynchian? Like there's a David Lynch vibe.
In what way?
It's like campy to the point of going into a weird dark
like
place.
It's an LA-based story, and there are these noirish elements to it that just, you know, that punctuate.
I mean,
like all of this true crime stuff.
He didn't ask how she died. Like in between all of the magnificence and the giganticness, you have these reminders of like, oh, this story happened. Like there's just something so charmingly LA about all of these celebrity management moments that go into just getting OJ like to
no
the
perp
sheriff's.
Walk. Yes. Absolutely. No perp walk, and then the chaos that ensues around like the Bronco chase, and then I totally forgot that they actually stopped the Bronco and, you know, they had their guns out and it was just like, well, I'm not gonna shoot at OJ Simpson, right?
So
and it's just such a and actually the way that it's framed also, the historical and documentary footage from that opens with, of course, the deep context of the Rodney King beating and trial and also the LA uprisings, to then point out and to then really kind of lay out for us the forms of privilege that celebrity and money win for people, the forms of justice that it makes available to people who have money.
As somebody who was like,
are you watching it, Guy?
Yes, of course.
Oh, okay.
Is everyone here watching?
Yeah, I think
I think everybody's riveted, right?
Yes, we need to have a proper conversation about this. But the as somebody who was like I was like in my late teens when it happened, and I understood the Rodney King beatings as a fact, but sort of did not understand the nuance or texture mm-hmm. of relationships between African Americans and the police, because that's what white privilege is. But there is something so interesting at this point in time to go back and look at this case
yeah.
and understand the way that consumption of the case by African Americans watching was a thing that I could not possibly understand. Mm-hmm. That it really was them understanding this is a fancier and bigger version of every time I have been stopped on the streets.
You know what's interesting to watch, because I talked about it last week, but I want to talk about it more in this context of this yeah. week's episode, because this week's episode was sort of starting to frame the case. It was a little less OJ and more about fame as it pertained mm-hmm. to how it was affecting. It really focused on fame, how everybody was starting to like sort of feel the taste of it.
Well, yeah. and that the story kind of is the bigness of the heads
sure. yeah.
of all of the legal
every
team.
Every single ego in yeah. that room is flying off that television, and now you understand how it became so chaotic and circus-like.
Right.
Because everyone was fighting for something, and everyone felt that they were right.
Everyone had an agenda.
Everybody right? had an agenda.
Yeah. Marsha Cross had her agenda.
She had an agenda.
Marsha Clark.
Clark. Sorry.
All I want.
Marsha Cross also had an agenda on Desperate Housewives.
She totally did.
More scenes. More scenes of Marsha Clark parenting. That's all I
yes,
want.
Yes, more scenes of that.
And of also, her parenting. Did you say? Yeah, and like yes. smoking while she's parenting.
Yes,
smoking and parenting. I can't get enough of David Schwimmer saying, "Juice, are you okay, Juice?
Juice. Oh, I know.
I love
He's
you,
so
Juice.
Loving to Juice. My yeah. God.
Well, that's to set it up because. At the, you know, I don't know if you know, but on his, he wanted nothing to do with OJ post.
Heard, everybody yeah, talked about yeah. this. That his, they like that.
His
it all
reaction
fell apart
when
after
the
that.
Case was yeah. when they announced the verdict.
The tonal perfection of the campness of Robert Kardashian and the campness of David Schwimmer.
Right.
So yeah. perfect, because I feel like
there should be a Venn diagram of it. Yeah. There should be some kind of illustration.
It is so yeah. perfect because in almost any other role, even this far from Friends, you're just like, it's Ross.
It's Ross.
But this sort of magnificently takes that energy that he's bringing and then just slightly redirects it to, no, this is the dead father of that family you watch.
Yeah. Right. It's just fascinating. It's 100% fascinating. I want us to talk about it every week.
All right.
I know. You might have to do like a little check-in.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Sorry, guys.
No, please. In a couple of weeks, we need to properly, like seven in, Karen will come back and we'll tear this shit apart. But on the subject of campness, I must now bring up the things that I'm all about this week. I've been consuming a lot of culture. I lost my dad last week, and so I have been doing a lot of self-care through media. And two things on the subject of campness. I saw Hail Caesar, which is Margaret seeing it this week. Mm-hmm. It is a fascinating movie. Don't know that it's a good movie.
Okay.
However,
interesting.
There is a 5-minute long dance sequence with Channing Tatum. Which
That's
is
all you need to say.
Magnificent. And it is like it really is the fact that he has like I recently like texted to a couple of friends like Channing Tatum is our Madeline Kahn. And I don't think that landed with them. But the fact
amazing.
That,
oh my God, yes, guy.
That guy has realized, no, I really should not be headlining most of my movies. Like, that me being the best 15 minutes of Hateful Eight, that me being...
You can go far on a hot 15 minutes.
Yes. And the thing is he's a hot guy. And there is this narrative of if you're a hot guy, you're supposed to get in spandex and be somebody's superhero. And him realizing... I'm something more than that.
Yeah, that's like, not his course.
Well, and he's got this skill set.
He's a sexy buffoon.
Yes, mm-hmm. He's a sexy buffoon. But the thing that makes it more okay and wonderful is he's so good at dancing that when you let
he's
him
like
do
Gene
it.
Gene Kelly. I really do believe yeah. he's got like Gene Kelly qualities, but, where he's athletic in the same kind of
yes,
way.
Yes, I mean, the thing is that like Fred Astaire was always so like nimble and thin, and Gene Kelly is like an athlete. And mm-hmm. and Channing Tatum is bringing a similar thing. But when you see a handsome man be that talented at something, you just want to hate him. And Channing Tatum lets us, like in Magic Mike, he lets us love him too much for it. And in this, he lets us hate him. But also, let us take a moment to speak of the Coen brothers, because we are now at a point in time when doing self-aware, charming little homoerotica is something we're a bit too fond of. Like where it is, get it, because he's not gay, but he's a little bit pretending to be gay. Mm. Get it? Mm-hmm. And it feels charmless. It feels like it has no sense of texture that really is the magnificence of what homosexuality is. And this was so perfectly Coen Brothers. It really was not leaning on it too hard, and it let it live. Like, it let it live for a 5-minute dance sequence instead of just giving you a couple of clips of it.
How gay was Clooney?
Oh, Clooney was...
I mean, he has the Caesar haircut.
I mean, he's the normal amount of gay. I would say a 3 of 10.
He's my gay lover, George Clooney, honestly. I mean, he's every lesbian's gay lover.
Yes. You guys can get Caesar haircuts together.
Exactly.
So that... But then the other thing I wanted to bring up is I watched Private Benjamin again.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Which is...
It's my urtext.
A thing I do sometimes. And explain that. You explain that on Facebook, but explain that to the listening
audience.
Well,
when I was once asked by this lesbian magazine thing, like, what is your favorite, like, most formative film? And it, for me, it was Private Benjamin.
Oh. Uh-huh.
And, you know, there's something about seeing this shiksa-looking Jewish girl, like, join the military and this, you know, and be subjected to these regimes that I always sort of found fascinating and alien to me. And to see her kind of have this weird relationship with Adami Dearest, yes, a.k.a. Eileen Brennan. And that to me was just like, there was something about all of that homosociality, all that female
her subversive
friendship.
Bottominess. The yeah. fact that she's always saying, yeah. that she's always saying, yes, but. Like,
I feel like I try to date a lot of Private Benjamins at that time, so I might still be doing that. I don't know.
But, does Sarah know this?
She does.
The fact of it being this magnificent Jap who isn't yeah. Again, it is not the sort of like leaning on it, heavy sail Jap, yeah. like, you know, hey, I love Gilda Radner's Rhonda Weiss, but like that it was something new that you like really hadn't seen it before, but it felt so needy and dependent. A woman who had been raised to be a companion animal for people and cannot make marriages work for a bunch of reasons outside of her control. And the fact that it is this movie about choices that really only like 40% of it takes place in the military, that it's a like a rom-com between a woman and having options is like...
But shout out to Goldie Hawn. Yeah. She always makes movies like that. There's always about... That, if you think about it, every yeah. movie she's ever made in the 80s was about... Too. She had a choice.
She occupied a really unique space yes. that no one else did. And I feel like no one has filled that
nope.
space.
No.
Not
nope.
that I can think of.
No, I think a lot of people have
shout
tried.
Shout out to her.
Yeah, I mean, including her daughter.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say, Kate Hudson, no.
But like, I feel like the Goldie Hawn that was being sold to you in media was very much underlining... She's sexy and funny. And this is just such a good reminder of, like, she was smart and funny and also sexy. I mean, it's not my job to pay attention to how sexy she is.
I could do push-ups and then, like, in the end, you know, ends up being an officer, right?
And
like,
also,
I love the uniforms, too. Hello.
Let's also have respect for Nancy Myers. And, that script is so amazing. And the sheer number of just jokes that it's got. All right, I realize I've gone on for a long time, but I need to recount one joke that is possibly...
Do it.
Okay.
I wish you had a little army cap, though, while you're doing
okay.
this.
So it's been established earlier in the film that she's never had an orgasm. Mm. And then she meets Armand DeSante at this bar, and he's going after her real hard, and she likes it. And he's like, let's go somewhere else. And she says, well, you know, usually I know a man's mother's maiden name before we kiss. And it's like, so perfectly, I'm a nice Jewish girl from Philadelphia. And he starts listing facts about himself. And then he says, and I'm Jewish. Smash cut to her orgasming. and then saying, so that's what I've been faking all these years. And like, it is such a perfect union of writing, directing, and performance. It's the best.
Sarah's a Jewish girl from Philadelphia.
Perfect.
All right. You guys are listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk about the Grammys. After this.
That whole thing?
Hi, this is Erica from Montana. I listen to Bullseye because no other program brings such delightful enthusiasm to exploring the creative process. It's a revelation every week.
I'm Jesse Thorne. We'll talk to cult British comedian Noel Fielding and to American stand-up's best-kept secret, Dwayne Kennedy, on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Yeah. Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I am your beloved host, Guy Branum. Mm-hmm. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Karen Tongson.
And you guys, we had a major award show this week. Mm-hmm. With a lot of...
Don't we know it?
A lot of official fireworks. Taylor Swift going after Kanye in her speech. We had a rather noteworthy performance from Kendrick Lamar. And a popularly believed to be subpar performance from The Weeknd. Guys, what did you think of the Grammys?
Oh, I mean, geez. Lady Gaga doing Bette Midler doing
David Bowie. Can you taste our enthusiasm? Can you taste it?
Lady Gaga
Please
doing
clap.
Bette Midler doing David Bowie. Bette Midler. I mean, and which I, frankly, I love Bette Midler. Sorry, in Vegas. But, you know.
Yeah, I enjoyed
I
it.
I think that those degrees of mediation and kind of like. You know,
the problem with Lady Gaga is being too on brand. Yeah. We know what she does, and when she comes and she does it. I mean, somebody posted on Facebook like a succession of photos of Lady Gaga makeup and a succession of nearly identical David Bowie makeup from 30 or 40 years beforehand. And it just reminded you the way that she's been doing a David Bowie tribute for most of her career.
Right. Well, yeah. I was thinking about how the fact, like, it was Madonna in the beginning. Like, everyone was always like, you're ripping off Madonna. And
yeah.
she's
yeah.
now switched trains to David Bowie, and it's been there all along. But, yeah. You know, what I thought was good about that whole performance is that she gave 110%. No one can accuse yes. her yeah. of sleeping on the job with that whole thing.
That's why. Right. The thing is an apt comparison.
Yes, yeah. I think is a woman who's working it.
She hustles hard.
Yes,
you know, to give show.
And don't we? Yeah. And don't we need a Liza Minnelli? You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like a Bette Midler, we Liza Minnelli.
We still have one.
But I mean, one for our generation.
We don't know the appropriate pill mixture to give her to let her be Liza these days.
Yes.
There was a period of time around 2008 when she was married to David Guest when we kind of got Liza for a while.
Right. Somebody needs to work on the cocktail
again.
But she, you know, Lady Gaga, I think there should have been like seven less songs. There was just so many songs.
There were too many. I mean,
yeah.
I think that
you couldn't sink into any of it. It just whipped by so fast.
There was a whole karaoke texture to the entire broadcast, actually.
Yes.
Which,
yes.
you know, like the stage design
was
just really, it was just all like, I felt like I was at a private room in Koreatown.
Yes.
You know, singing Weeknd songs. I mean, I could have done as, I mean, you know, whatever. I tweeted
it
about the Weeknd.
Karen, there's something about Lauryn Hill was supposed to be with him.
Oh, really?
I think so.
There were a lot of people who were supposed to be there.
Yeah.
AKA just, Rihanna.
Right.
Yeah.
Back to Lady Gaga for a moment.
Yeah.
Is my fundamental problem with her pastiche-ness? Is my fundamental problem with her that she so much is evocative of other things that I am always fearing that I just am dealing with something fake?
Like, yes. Who is she?
Wow, guy.
Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. She's kind of a really...
I mean, she's so talented.
Astute mimic,
no,
in a way.
Yeah, no one's questioning that she's super, super talented.
Right.
And, I mean...
But what's her voice?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if I really know what her voice is.
That is the thing that I think
like
is disconcerting about her. Like, her perspective is really just, it's disconcerting because you can sense the talent. It's like her vocal ability to inhabit. Like, you know, I was just listening to You and I, that country-ish song that was a hit of hers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had no idea it was Lady Gaga when I first heard it on the radio. I was like, does Carrie Underwood have a new song? Or like Faith, did Faith Hill come back? And, you know, and I think that that is, I mean, David Bowie, though he may have inhabited many different personae, had that David Bowie voice and that David Bowie texture that was distinctly his. And I think that is that you know, Gaga is perhaps the artist of the post-karaoke generation that becomes really scary for people because we cannot track or trace the texture of her originality.
Yeah.
I don't want to spend any more time talking about her.
Yeah.
Talk to me about Kendrick Lamar.
Because I'm sick of her.
Yeah.
She got paid by Intel. She got paid.
All right.
Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, yeah.
Here's the thing about his performance. And somebody did a side-by-side comparison of Michael Jackson doing They Don't Really Care About Us. And his video was sort of similar with In the Chains and feeling enslaved. Kendrick's not saying he's being enslaved by the industry. He's saying he's being enslaved by his very being. And there is a really fine line. That is why I think that they went after Michael, because they were like, you're telling us you've made all this fucking money and now you're going to say the industry is trying to pin you up and hang you up on charges or whatever. Kendrick is not attacking the industry or his fan base. He's attacking the world at large for coming at him about his culture. It was not a subdued performance, but it was subdued in the way he was presenting it. It was art.
It was
artful. It did. It felt like
it
art.
It felt like art.
Deep and in the context of happening right after that performance from the cast of Hamilton, right?
And Beyonce.
And Beyonce. And then but you know, even in just the context of the broadcast, just like the theatricality of
yes.
it, but and also just that the beauty that is performance art. We talk
yes.
like last mention of Gaga. We always talk about her as being the kind of performance art, like
right.
pop star. What Kendrick Lamar did, like just busted the boundaries of everything having to do with our understanding of
right.
how performance art could translate to a broader broadcast media.
Yeah.
There's something so hard about the fact that we as Americans love to apply the ancient art of branding to everything that we do. And we've been doing it a lot to politics in like the past couple of years, but it makes it so much harder to look at something that is art, that is ambiguous, that is mm-hmm. personal, and be like, everybody's supposed to have a headline about it.
Yeah.
Like everyone in an audience full of well-dressed white people is supposed to understand like how they're supposed to respond to it, to be on the right side of things.
Right.
And like art is a thing you shouldn't pick teams about. Like
sure.
it's mm-hmm. it does make it hard. Margaret, what were your thoughts on Kendrick?
I loved it. I mean, I thought it was really powerful. There was this look in his eye that was just so – that alone was so grounding and
yeah.
powerful and like total commitment. And, you know, at the Grammys, it always feels like everything's a stunt. Do you
yeah.
know what I mean? Like, you know, medleys and everything's – there's like five
right.
different musicians playing the Lionel Richie, you know, medley strung together. But with Kendrick, it was like complete ownership of the stage and
yeah.
his moment and his style. And like nobody else really did that the whole
night.
And a
night. Different urgency behind it.
Yeah.
You know, as Winter was sort of saying.
Right. It had this like political potency to it that like really nobody else.
And instead, he wasn't there to trump other people's performances, which
no.
is what a lot of Grammy performances feel like, is that I'm supposed
Showboating.
To show up and
Outstand
blow everybody
and
out of the water.
And grandstand.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
the one thing that I really, really appreciate, and maybe I'm not giving the Ampus enough credit for, is especially after the spectacle that Beyonce pulled, to give people a platform, African Americans, a platform to say, look, I'm going to do my song. It's a hit and everybody loves this song, but I'm going to do it my way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to talk about, I'm going to throw this on top of it. I kind of, as shitty as your show was, guys, I'm going to give you credit for taking that leap. Taking a leap towards that and allowing him to present that. It's emotional. This is a very emotional time to be a Black person in America, to have felt like, when I think about the first time I was with my entire family watching Michael Jackson moonwalk mm-hmm. on the 25th anniversary of Motown.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was huge. And then to fast forward 30 years later, and we still need moments like that to remind us that we're valid and worthy of being on a stage like that and celebrated. It's emotional.
The place of performance in the Grammys is always so fascinating to me because it is unlike other award shows. I mean, the VMAs to some extent, but like because these are musical artists, you can have those moments on a Grammy stage where Ricky Martin shows up, not a person who people know, and leaves somebody who is very famous in America.
Mm-hmm.
And it is exciting. And I also really it is a gigantic and outsized award show to have in this corridor of respectable movie award shows.
Mm-hmm.
And like one of the most fun things about working on Fashion Police was realizing like everybody's going to be wearing the same outfits to all of the spring award shows. And then for the Grammys, it will be a shit show and it
yeah.
will be magnificent. People will do great things and terrible things.
I have to say, actually, you know, in talking about the sort of awards show spectacles, even of civil rights, like Kendrick Lamar's performance so like transcended the genre insofar as we're used to the stirring, like, you know, kind of middle of the road civil rights performance that we get from like a John Legend
at the Academy Awards. Yeah.
And, you know, Glory and like the uplifting gospel choir and the whole deal. This was someone taking everything that has happened in the context of African-American musical culture, art, et cetera, in the last like 25 years and insisting upon its kind of political saliency and, you know, value when in these middle of the road contexts, we tend to capitulate to like the Soaring Gospel Choir and somebody like John Legend, like, mm-hmm. you know, performing.
White people know how to process those narratives of civil rights, and they don't mean anything to us anymore. We just go through the motions of it, and it's not pushing you outside of your boundaries in any way.
Ava DuVernay tweeted that, like, you know, I heard that Kendrick Lamar's performance slayed in the real world, but like in the actual venue of Staples, people like didn't cheer as much. They didn't know what to do with it. I mean, that was kind of an interesting thing to hear or to see her having tweeted about that performance. I mean, and you do get that. You did get that meme of like, you know, white people stunned into like, what's happening? Like in the shadow of the flames, right?
It is the difference between the music industry and the film and television industries that at the Academy Awards, there just aren't black people. But like at the Grammys, it has always been the case that it is a large number of African-American performers performing for the white people who take a cut of their money. All right. Let us now step to the moment of we have our first two-time, is it Record of the Year or Album of the Year?
Album of
the
Year?
I always get confused about, like, is Record of the Year like a kind of like a single? It's like
Record
it's
of
like
the Year is
recording.
A single.
Song it's like the whole year. Team that makes
but
it.
But Song of the Year versus Record of the Year,
Song
like,
of the Year
I feel.
Song of the Year is the writer. Sheeran.
Okay.
Is, but our first two-time Album of the Year female Album of the Year winner, was Taylor Swift in a tube top and pants. And she got up and responded to the recent sassiness from Kanye West. A lot of people thought it was really, really tacky. The narrative, we all know I'm officially Team Taylor now. But I've just been so annoyed since she just gave him the mic the first time he tried to take the mic from her. And I like that she claimed voice to some extent, because like I feel like 1989 has been a narrative of going from like a tool for other people to make money to somebody who has something to say. Maybe not the most interesting things, but something to say. But also a lot of people thought it was tacky.
I had mixed feelings about it. Mm. On one hand, everything on paper about her speech, I was like, yes, I love it.
Sure.
But it reminds me, like, she was using feminism in sort of the same way that she uses the word squad. Do you know what I mean? Where it's like, it's exclusivity. It's you're not in it.
Right.
And I'm going to use it as kind of a weapon instead of some kind of inclusive, positive thing.
Well, she said it with a lot of vitriol. She wasn't saying it like, hey, guys. She was saying it with like, and then, you know, Tina took my Bond bell and I knew she took it.
Yes.
And she lied because I saw it in her backpack.
Exactly. Like that. It was so pointed. She was just like grilling the camera with her eyes. And it was like, are you at home, Kanye, listening to this? You know what I mean? And I don't know. There's just something about it that felt catty and not the right way. Even though I support what she's saying. Do you know what I mean? Like it just was, it was like all in the undertone that I just don't like. And I mean, Kanye deserved it. Like what he says about her on that song is ridiculous and sexist and crappy.
Right.
You know, she was accepting an award in that moment that he interrupted her. He didn't make her famous. She was like accepting an award. What I mean? Plus anybody, I mean, I was working in the music industry at that time. I mean, rather covering it. And the momentum behind Taylor Swift was insane. Like, there's no way that no one was making her famous but herself. Uh-huh. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, she came up out of nowhere and kind of, like, was just a storm brewing for a long time. So, I mean, I just, there's something about it that rubbed me the wrong way.
This is
you know?
When she toggled over into the Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem.
Yeah, foot in the mouth. You know, like, just like, kind of.
I mean, I think that, you know, I joked earlier, I think that it was at the VMAs that Taylor was starting her Hillary Clinton campaign around being, you know, the diplomatic mainstream feminist to a certain extent, you know, like, and that she was just like, you know, like reaching out to, you know, the whole deal.
No.
And this is, you know, I feel like there's, I think that there's a way in which she has now achieved that kind of status of like, sure, she's solid, she's a feminist, et cetera, like Hillary or what have you. And then, you don't feel that?
No, I feel like they're the aunt and the uncle at Thanksgiving that you just, you're like, please, Auntie Susan, and please.
I know, oh, I did have a little feeling of that, too. Where you know I was just like, you're billionaires arguing.
You're arguing. You know? Yeah, that's, despite your debt.
The feud thing is
no
like,
one has not had less success because one somebody has won over the other.
But it's the question of how much are these people making a business out of it. Like, at the VMAs, when you had, Nicki Minaj formally end her feud with Taylor Swift and then formally begin a feud with Miley Cyrus that we've actually seen nothing of. So that undercuts my point. But it's like, how much are people doing this just so that they have a way of getting a passive PR stream? Like, it's all about getting PR that you don't have to pay for.
Right.
So that, because buzz matters, because buzz does give, like, lift and attention to your work.
I mean, I think, too, that, like, maybe just don't even mention Kanye. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, aren't you just sort of above it at this point?
Right.
Like, he's obviously kind of spinning his wheels and, but like, rehashing some bullshit.
I felt like that was the pressure. That's a pressure that was created, though, by the kind of media. But also by the kind of political import of some of the performances that preceded hers. Mm. I mean, you know, from Hamilton to Kendrick Lamar and, like, the, you know, the sheepish, like, the cutaway to sheepish Ed Sheeran, like, watching Kendrick Lamar, you know, and I think
it's
that there
ego.
Was a certain,
it's
you know,
ego.
But I feel like,
you feel like there was some sense of, like, well,
I have to have some sort of political stake or message
that is more profound than whatever, like, 1989 was a great pop album. And in any other year, when it wasn't,
but she could have said the same sentiment. She could have had the same sentiment without that little knife in there that just made it kind of tacky.
I just feel like women are always so encouraged towards propriety, towards not rocking the boat.
True.
That when a woman does rock the boat, as, you know, an outside observer of feminism and women's condition, I'm like, good. Yay. I'm happy for it. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
You guys, I'm so excited to introduce to you my new baby, Getting Curious with Jonathan Van Ness. This is going to be a really fun look at things that I find curious, whether it's a menstrual cup, it might be the Romanoff family, it might be fracking, it could be Carly Fiorina. I don't even know. Who knows? It's going to be whatever I think is interesting. I can't wait to bring it to you guys. We're going to be bringing in content experts. I'm going to be learning the things. It's only going to take about 30 minutes for you to expand your baby brains with me and have a super fun time. So I can't wait to see you on our first episode of Getting Curious.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. Who's in the studio?
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Karen Tongson.
And every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? Margaret Wappler, what's your current jam?
Well, I played a Santigold song before, and I basically am just now going to leak out her new album slowly on Pop Rocket. So this next song that I'm going to play is called Chasing Shadows. It's from her album 99 Cents. It's coming out February 26th. It just, I don't know, her sound and her style, it just thrills me. It fills me with joy. It's so, like, light and smart and perfect. Here it is.
That's charming.
It's actually the perfect song to finish a beer to.
That's true. Just like one last light sip.
I feel like a light lager. I wouldn't really pair an ale or like a stout with that. Yeah,
yeah. It's like something sparkly.
It has a little San Francisco 90s like Sunday dance party in the afternoon.
Yes,
thing
it totally does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dolores Park.
Winner, what's your jam?
I am, as of this week, a free agent again and going back to being
Get that freelance lifestyle.
Woo! And I feel free. And can't talk about it, but I will let Denise Williams tell us about it because one of my favorite songs that she ever sang is Free. And this is Free by Denise Williams.
So sweet. I love Denise.
Waiting to exhale.
Yeah.
Just waiting.
God, she's got such a sweet voice.
She sure does. Thank you for cutting it off just like that, Christian.
Karen, what's your jam?
Okay, so in, you know, because Natalie Cole was deprived of the Grammy tribute, mm-hmm. I thought that I would dedicate my song to her this week. And This Will Be has been sullied by its associations with the eHarmony ads, even though it's still a great song.
God.
But let's go ahead.
eHarmony is ruined. So many things.
I feel like this song, I thought it was written by Dan Warren because it has that feel, but I think this is apropos, at least my sentiments, to Natalie Cole. So we'll go ahead and kind of fade in, if we can, to Miss You Like Crazy.
You keeps going strong. I remember the things that we used to do. You like crazy. Ever since you went away.
Well, there you go. Thank you, Natalie Cole. We miss you like crazy.
Karen.
And your prescription is ready.
Karen, do you watch Drag Race?
I have not seen Drag Race in about a season or two.
All right. Did you see the Natalie Cole This Will Be performance?
I did not.
Okay. This was several years ago, but it was a simply mediocre queen. Who standing before Natalie Cole realized I have to bring it in this moment.
Yeah.
And she provided nothing else in that season that was impressive. But in that moment, and like the it was a lip sync for your life, the queen who she was up against had nothing, and I forget her name, but she sold it. She lived it. She rose to the moment. It was a like it really was the best of what drag could and should be, because when there's a diva in front of you, it's your job to reflect her light.
Absolutely.
As I do with the three of you today.
I love you, guy.
All right.
I said I love you, guy.
I love you, Winter. But from that extremely gay moment to
all of our moments
less
are gay.
Gay.
Come on.
I lost my dad this week, and so my jam is what his favorite song was. So let's hear it.
And there's the riff.
Every guitar student learns with the song.
Here I'm gonna be a baby. Yeah. Here I'm gonna love you.
Here I'm gonna be a baby.
Don't you know that?
All right, you've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Karen Tongson. We'll post show notes every week at MaximumFun.org, and you can also find links in the episode description for this podcast. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Gobi81, Vivi, and three Chinese characters I cannot read for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Get in touch with us on Twitter, at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group this week. Tell us what's your favorite song that uses non-traditional instruments or their genre. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are the charming Christian Duenas and the alluring Colin Anderson.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.